Well, is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and coffee bar. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
You're listening to The Information Advantage. This is WILL Urbana. It's a broadcasting service of the College of Communications here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Coming to you live today from the Farm Progress Show site outside of Decatur. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Todd Gleason. I work for University of Illinois Extension. We're joined this afternoon by two distinguished colleagues who work in the international area to talk about the marketplace and how the global markets have changed and the internationalization of commodities. We'll be talking with Rich Feltus, who's the Director of Research at REFCO, and Steve Sonka, who is the former Director of the National Soybean Research Laboratory at the University of Illinois, and Professor Emeritus of Agricultural Econ at the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences. Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for being with us. Let's start with you, Rich. Give us 3 to 5 minutes about your experience in the international marketplace. Tell us what's been happening, how it's been changing.
Well, I think the discussion headlines with China, of course, the world's largest producer and consumer of food, and the explosive growth that is going on over there in soybean product and soybean product use. They are now the world's largest importer of soybeans. The expansion in their soybean imports, their domestic meal and oil use has been nothing short of phenomenal. And the growth rate continues to be quite strong. USDA estimates in the year ahead that Chinese protein use will be up another 4.3 million tons. That's soybean, soybean meal. So they are the primary growth market in oilseed use and will continue to be so. Almost half the Chinese population still lives on less than $2 a day. If one reflects on the Chinese government and what they have done over the last decade, I think without question their most impressive achievement is bringing 400 million people out of a dollar a day poverty and moving them up the income chain. And as they move up that income chain, their demand for food products has increased substantially. As we look ahead, Chinese grain stocks are declining. There is no question there are more people moving up the income ladder that are requiring more protein-based diets, which means corn and soy meal. And what we're all waiting for in the grain trade, of course, is the time when they become shift from being net exporters of corn to being net importers of corn. Both USDA, the private trade, have overestimated how soon that's going to occur. The best guesstimates are that it'll now be sometime within the next 3 to 5 years. And when it does, it's going to mean another significant ratcheting up for global corn demand. So that's one we're watching very carefully. Let me just touch on the Black Sea, if I may, for a moment.
You may.
The Black Sea wheat exports, which prior to 2000 were barely 1% of world trade, thanks to a couple of good crops, thanks to a currency depreciation, thanks to high global prices in this 02 to 03 period, Black Sea wheat exports shot up to 16% of total global grain trade. They've got a fairly good crop coming on now. We're going to be rebounding global exports out of the Black Sea in the year ahead, and USDA feels that there will be ongoing growth as we look out over the next decade, although not to the extent that we saw here the last few years. Because of their challenges with bringing up productivity, their lack of infrastructure, their lack of common law, contract law for grain contracts, and land ownership. So that's an area that I think perhaps puts a dampener on wheat prices globally, because they do have a strong comparative advantage in wheat production and 3/4 of what the Black Sea exports is essentially wheat products and wheat. And then finally, just touching upon Brazil, it's interesting to reflect that since the late 90s, the land expansion, of course, in Brazil has been phenomenal. We all know that. If you work it out to how much agricultural land has been brought into production, it's about 7 football fields per minute every hour of every day of every week of every month. That growth is only going to be stalled and slowed down here as we look ahead to the 06 crop year because of their high farm debts and the low soybean prices. We think that land expansion will temper out. But the fact remains, as global growth in soybean demand continues, Brazil is going to be the source of the new acres we need. We have a 10 million ton a year basic expanding diet in global soybean use. Brazil is going to be the source of it. Their total undeveloped land is equal to the entire cropland currently under cultivation in this country. We could only wish that the crude oil market had the kind of untapped reserve in production potential that the soybean market has in Brazil. So they're going to be tough competitors for the U.S. That's not going to change. But it does suggest in our markets, because of our very strong domestic offtake here and our expanding demand for protein meal here, biodiesel, it's going to be difficult to build soybean stocks in this country. And so with that, there's implications for spreads, for flat price, for the relationship between FOB prices in this country and Brazil, all issues that we can talk and touch upon later, as Todd wishes to do.
I think certainly we will. Rich Feltus, of course, is the Director of Research at REFCO. With us also again today is Steve Sonka, who is the former Director of the National Soybean Research Lab at the University of Illinois, Ag Economist Emeritus from the U of I, and to tell us a little bit more about his view of the global marketplace.
Well, I think I'll look in kind of a strategic dimension. One of the things that we did at NSRL, and NSRL is still doing, is thinking strategically about the need for protein, animal protein, and then, of course, vegetable protein as soy. Thinking about some work we did for the Illinois Soybean Association a couple of years ago, we looked globally at need for animal protein, beef, pork, poultry, aquaculture. A number of interesting messages come from that. One of those is if we think first a little bit historically, for much of the last century, the last half of the last century, the expansion of the market for soy, market for corn, was driven by demand for animal protein in the wealthy countries. The U.S., the Canada, the Western Europe, Japan. Major expansion in demand for protein fueled major growth in our soybean and corn markets, as well as growth of our animal industries. One of the first messages, if you look forward, and we did some modeling where we looked for the first 25 years of this century, is that market isn't going to grow. Where we had our growth in the past is not our future. A very strong message that, with the U.S. as the one exception, Western Europe, Japan, looking at population declines, looking at slow income growth, even though they're well-off countries, slow income growth relative to the globe. The U.S. is an exception because we will probably add 50 million people in the next 25 or 30 years. That will add 10-15% to our population in a relatively well-off country. We'll see some growth in demand for animal protein here in the U.S., but we are the exception. The other message is Asia. When we look at China, when we look at India, when we look at East Asia, Malaysia, Indonesia, large countries that have experienced income growth over the last 20 or 30 years. If that income growth continues, we're looking at major expansion at a global level, not quite doubling the need for beef, pork, poultry, aquaculture that we have today. Major expansion in demand in China, in India. In China, it's heavily pork and poultry. India, it's heavily poultry. In all of Asia, it's heavily fish. The natural diet there would say, as people get more income, particularly low-income people that want to increase their consumption of fish, the natural fisheries can't provide that. So we're looking at aquaculture of some form or another. If we think about the production side, one thing we need to remember is, and here we are at the Farm Progress Show and we see all these tremendous machines and this huge capacity, most of the world's production of food is not here. I mean, and the big players, we are only one of several big players in terms of ag production. We lead the world in the production of beef, but in the and broilers, but in poultry and in eggs, China dominates the world. Where we have 20% of the market in beef, they have over 40% of the market in pork. India is the world's largest producer of milk. So these are very large, agricultures, very diverse. But as Rich mentioned earlier, income and poverty is concentrated in the rural areas. How those unfold will have tremendous impact on our trade potentials as well. Then the last thing I'll tell you just strategically to throw out is if we look at competitiveness and we look at Brazil, I think a question for U.S. agriculture is how do you become cost competitive? In this global economy, our land costs are making us a high cost, not the highest cost producer, but we're certainly not low cost producers. On Thursday here at the Farm Progress Show, they're going to be talking about farm policy, and hopefully that part of that discussion will be how do we develop alternative farm policies that don't end up with us being a high-cost producer when we have to compete in the world where the world price is determined by economics as much or more than by policy. So I'll conclude with that.
I want to stay with you just for a second, and then Rich, we're going to come back to you, because, and I'd like to stay with the Americas, South America and North America, and talk about soybeans. Rich suggested, I think you did this, that South America, Argentina, and Brazil have become and will become more importantly in the future the place where the world will be picking most of its soybeans up into the export market, and that U.S. will be raising beans for the domestic use. The question on this one is, does Brazil have the infrastructure at this point to be able to take on that kind of load in the world market? How fast have they been able to develop, and how much do they have yet to develop in terms of railways, roads, ports, in order to get beans out of the field into the open marketplace?
Well, let me just start out by clearly, Brazil is going to be a major player in world trade. And I'm not talking about soybeans. U.S. is still going to be exporting a lot of soybeans in the future. And part of that is just the northern hemisphere, southern hemisphere. You grow the crop at different times of the year, and the cost of holding beans is a big issue in real trade. So it's not like the export market in the U.S. is going to disappear, because there are good business reasons that have to do with holding grain for long periods of time, where U.S. is going to be exporting for long periods of time. We're going to be a player in the export market. Now, the infrastructure question in Brazil, of course, is, the thing we can predict with certainty is they will need and they will generate tremendous amounts of infrastructure and rail and roads and ports. That's a safe prediction as long as you don't ask me when. Clearly, it will happen. It's going to happen slower than their politicians say, because politicians are like that all over the world. We're talking huge amounts of capital. One of the reasons I think it will continue to expand its infrastructure is the government of Brazil has been receptive to foreign direct investment. If that government should move in directions that's not receptive to foreign direct investment, that infrastructure is going to slow down, because my personal opinion is much of that infrastructure will need private sector money. This is not so much about the public building of roads. We may see more toll roads that are actually privately financed. Well, for that to work, the government of Brazil has to remain stable as it has for the last 10 or 20 years. But nothing is certain in politics in Latin America. So there are a lot of just strategic uncertainties there. The other thing about Brazil that's interesting is to think about land as a variable factor. and that as, and Rich talked about this, there's more land to expand, but it's only going to expand if the investors perceive it as profitable. So if soybean prices go down, expansion of land will pull back. And when if bean prices are relatively high, that expansion will continue. So it's very different than the U.S. mentality of we have our land and we just have to cover our variable cost and we're going to produce. In Brazil, that land at the margin, either the new land or land that's just recently been brought in, will the amount of that that's available will fluctuate with the soybean price, and will act, I think, in the long run to if you will, put a long-run band around the highs in soybean prices and the lows in soybean prices.
Rich, if you could clarify for me, and there are a couple of things. You talked about direct investment from outside nations, China, of course, investing heavily into the railway industry in Brazil, and you may discuss that, but I want to know more about your feelings over the long run in terms of where you see the United States and Brazil capable of competing against each other. And how you perceive Brazil, and I'm from your opening comments, I guess I'm thinking that you're seeing Brazil, South America, as a primary source for beans in the world, although there is the north-south and two-crop sort of thing every 6 months coming on into the marketplace that you have to deal with, and the idea that, as Steve said, that businesses will not want to hold carry beans when they can bring them in from other sources, so that they may switch which area they're importing from over time. Mm-hmm. So start maybe with that portion of it, and then tell me more about how you see the United States and Brazil competing over the next 20 years.
Well, I certainly concur with Steve that the U.S. will continue to exert an influence and have a presence in the global soybean export market. But given the cap in overall U.S. crop acreage, given the expanding mandate that's coming from the legislation regarding ethanol and corn demand in this country, I would submit that the growth in global soybean export market share is likely to be captured by South America. At the moment, from an infrastructural standpoint, our affiliates in South America feel very strongly that over the last 2 years, Argentina has made much greater strides in improving their infrastructure and export capability. It's a smaller country, it's easier than Brazil has. Brazil, it's our sense, is reasonably comfortable with a 50 million ton type soybean crop, but a 60 million ton crop, which is a little bit, which is approximately what USDA believes it'll be here in 06. Our people believe that from an infrastructure standpoint, it is going to be a real strain on their system to handle a crop that large, because the port capacity has not been increased in the last 2 years. There have been strides over the last 5 years, I know, in railroads and waterways, but in the last 2 years, it has leveled out. And it all is suggestive of wider basis levels, lower prices delivered to these interior farmers. As the demand for transportation goes up with higher crops, given the same level of infrastructure. Now, in terms of the impact they're having right now, it's very dramatic. U.S. new crop sales of soybeans to China are... you can count them in cargoes on a couple of hands. Last couple of years, we had 2 million tons already sold to them. Who's making up the difference? Well, Argentina, which had that record crop last year, is basically already met a fair share of China's October, September, November import needs. So as we go forward, I would say, and certainly let me make this final point, our sources in China tell us that they increasingly, the Chinese crushers, are looking for ways in South America to bypass middlemen, to go more direct to either local elevators, even to large producers, to source soybeans, to make contractual arrangements with those beans, because the Chinese feel that the middlemen is taking out too much and charging too much. So that's a developing issue that we're going to see unfold here over the next 5 years. Watch the Chinese and the Cargill ADMs and so forth in South America. But I think as we move forward, Brazil is certainly going to be there. They're going to supply the growth. But the infrastructural issues are still a big question, how they get financed, when they get financed, as Steve has suggested, and whether or not all of that's going to occur in tandem with the productive growth in capacity that they have on the table and that they can use, given the right price incentive.
Well, certainly it seems to me that if the Chinese are looking to tap farmers or elevators directly, that they're working with much smaller lots than, or unless the, well, I suppose the farmers there are in that 20,000 in the United States acre size, so maybe they're large enough that they can tap directly into those areas. And U.S. farmers would complain about the same thing, that they'd like to have a higher price and get rid of the middlemen, but they don't want to farm 20,000 acres of soybeans here in the United States.
Well, no, but as you know, there are some. Maggi, the largest soybean producer in the world, is up there in Mato Grosso. There are other large farmers. Those are the kinds of sources that the Chinese now are looking for, too.
And that's running in the 100,000 acres of soybeans as opposed to 20,000 acres. So does that change the way U.S. markets have to deal with China at all?
Overall, I would say that our internal infrastructure and delivery transportation system is much more efficient than Brazil. We have this gifted waterway system right down through the center of the country. We have reasonably efficient rail and truck staging facilities. We have very low loss at harvest or through the storage process. South America has the production comparative advantage. We have the transportation infrastructure comparative advantage. And I would say in those times when their production is overrunning their infrastructure, the U.S. will have a competitive advantage into those Asian markets.
Let's discuss a little bit more about what U.S. strategies might be in the future. So we know that the Chinese population is 1.3 billion and growing fairly rapidly every year. On comparison, the United States population is 270 million roughly. So they've got four times the number of folks thereabouts in China. They're getting richer. And there is a great disparity between the coastal areas, which have become more urbanized, and the interiors. But the question is this: on the urban areas along the coast, will they be looking to process from the United States raw commodities, corn and soybeans, which we can run down the infrastructure that's here already, that can be run to the ports, whether it's out to the west or whether you go down the Mississippi River, or will they be looking to import beef and pork from the U.S. and where do we lie as we go 10 to 15 years down the road? How do you set yourself up for a strategy to service China, and is it a raw commodity or a more finished product?
Well, and the safe prediction is it'll be some of everything, and it will be some of everything. It is not going to be all one or all one, but another. The thing I think about on the coast of China is infrastructure issues and water issues. And China on those coasts already is worrying about becoming a high-cost source of labor and losing their low-cost labor advantage in the coast, and how do manufacturers compete. And as people become more wealthy, they're going to want, yes, more food, but they want more amenities. They want a higher quality of life. Don't necessarily want to live next to a pork processing plant. Probably don't want pigs growing in their backyard because, they're moving into an urban and then a suburban life. If you focus on water, I would suggest that it would make a lot of sense if I were the guru of China to say, I want to use water where I have to use it in China and write directly with people. If I can bring in processed product and get the benefit of the America's water, that's what the economy is going to move me towards doing that. And I mean, it's just about water supply and huge numbers of people and getting water to processing facilities, which driving through here by Lake Decatur and seeing ADM's water processing facility, their own water, waste treatment plant. If I'm running China, I'd rather have that waste treatment plant and the water use over in Brazil or in the U.S. and use water directly for human consumption on those coasts, because it is crowded.
Well, I hadn't thought about water as a scarce resource in that terms, but there will be around the globe many
right.
places that will be,
yeah.
be looking to
right.
use water in those terms. And I may want to come back to that. What has your research told you about how China will be importing products from the United States in the near term and long term both?
I agree with Steve. It'll be a mixture of both more imported meat and poultry, but also soybean processing is going to be a big feature. The country itself has invested heavily in soybean processing. Their capacity is well over their annual usage right now. New plants are still being constructed, even though margins here in the last months have been very poor. An interesting development in terms of the Chinese government stepping back from the soybean processing industry, and I think this is very important to note. As you know, a couple of years ago, we had Chinese import restrictions throwing up artificial barriers against imports of U.S. soybeans for reasons of contamination and so forth, in effort, in essence, to protect their domestic soybean producers and their domestic soybean processors. Well, now we're in an era with this demand expanding so rapidly that even with this recent era of low margins, even a year and a half ago when the Chinese got stuck with a lot of high-priced beans and there was a $300 million loss to the merchandising industry, the people that accumulate these cargoes and ship them and take the risk. Notwithstanding all of that, the Chinese government has basically held back. They're letting these people sink or swim on their own. And I honestly think that's a good development. Get the government out of it. These industries should stand and produce and either be profitable or lose on their own. If you talk to a South American soy processor, when they talk about the most efficient crushers in the world, they talk about the ones, the new ones, along the coastal areas of China. Not only is it the newest technology, but we know they've got cheaper labor rates, perhaps higher than they were a couple of years ago, but still well below what we have in this country or in South America. So I think the Chinese do have a comparative advantage in that, and that is going to supply the bulk of their growth in protein demand for their domestically produced livestock. There's certainly been a tremendous expansion in confinement operations in China, but also in their import. We know they're buying a lot of beef and pork, and that's going to continue as well. They have to look at all sources to maintain food stability, which is such a politically sensitive issue in China. As you know, as recently as the late 50s, early 60s, there were 40 million people in China that died of famine. So that is, without question, this food stability issue is crucial and central to the Communist Party and how they want to take the country forward.
Will they take the country forward away from staples like rice? And as the population becomes more wealthy, depend more heavily on poultry and pork and beef over time? And I've got a follow-up question to that too.
I believe it won't be so much Beijing taking the country forward in that way as it is the growth in incomes and the spending behavior demanding more food. Dairy is a tremendous expansion and growth production industry in China. We know they've been importing a lot of our high-quality livestock here to expand that industry, to improve efficiency, and only one way that's going, and it's going to continue to go up.
Then the follow-up to that question is, if they're going to get wealthier, they're going to eat more meats, they'll probably will they raise the meats there, or will they import the meat? So will the commodities be coming in from the United States and Brazil to feed those animals? And will they do that on the coastal areas, or can they do that in the interior?
In my view, they are going to continue to promote and expand their domestic livestock industry.
They already raise the most hogs in the world.
Yes.
And I think that will, I think that is not going to change. Whatever we say about the leaders in Beijing, their overall food policy is for domestic consumption to be met by domestic production. And they, as a country, as a communist philosophy, are loath to the idea of becoming overly dependent upon another country for too much of their food supply. Now, I know it's already happened in the oilseed sector, but they politically do not view oilseeds as centrally strategic and vital to their food supply as they do corn and wheat. Those are the most politically, and rice, politically sensitive commodities.
We often talk about China and soybeans, but they raise the second largest corn crop on the globe.
Yes, they
do. It's about half the size of what the U.S. raises this year. Last year it was 11.8 billion U.S. Crop size. This year we're at 10.3 billion or something thereabouts. And their crop size will be bigger this year, according to USDA, up to 130 million metric tons, which is 5.1 or 2 billion bushels. So still in that half the size of the U.S. Corn crop. And you expect them to expand that to meet their burgeoning need for meats?
The only expansion that's going to occur in Chinese corn production is going to have to be through productivity. Their area situation is capped. They have been experiencing a net loss of acres in recent years until just last year. If one looks at a long-term trend line yield chart for China corn yields, it's essentially flat for the last 7 years. I was recently at a presentation by Pioneer Seed Corn, which is has a presence in China. And they're working hard to introduce their varieties. They're just a small part of the market. But their assessment is that it's going to be difficult for China to dramatically increase productivity in the short term in China. So this expanding demand for corn that's occurring domestically, and again, there are people that think USDA is only partially estimating the growth in Chinese feed usage that's occurring every year. This expanding demand is going to be, it has been met by the drawdown of internal stocks, and as most experts believe, within 3 to 5 years, they're going to be forced to enter the global corn market and buy it in.
Steve, I have a question for you, but very quickly. Their corn yields have been flat, and I don't recall, in the United States, this year we're looking for 138 to 142 bushels an acre raised on what's been a short crop in Illinois. It seems to me that their average yield is in that 118, or am I just way
yes,
too high?
It's in the low 100s.
In the low 100s, just for comparison's sake. Yes. Okay, Steve, so you've done a lot of work with soybeans, but I want you to talk about corn, because it appears that it may be that rather than bean exports, that corn exports will continue to be the U.S. growth spot, especially as it pertains to China. What's your view?
Well, I think that's right. In the longer run assessment, you know, corn has, I think, more export potential. Although, you know, we tend to get fixated on China and we tend to get fixated on the U.S. And oftentimes, I mean, it's a global market. The global market for food is global market for these commodities. If some corn were to shift to Latin America more than we expect, then there's going to have to grow the beans somewhere else. And so, I mean, there is flexibility in the system when we think about it at a global level. We want to get our minds around corn in the U.S., but we need also to be able to think about globally what's happening. I mean, will India become for political reasons, would China prefer to import from India? Well, then somebody has to supply India, another hugely growing economy with massive populations in rural areas and in urban areas. So at a global level, we tend to focus on, I tend to think about where is the growth and demand for food and commodities. Where are the natural resources going to come from, which is why I keep going back to water, and where is there water available in excess for what than what humans are going to need desperately to use for their direct consumption.
Have you put the pins on the globe for that one?
I mean, the Americas have to be a major source of the production. There's the Black Sea area, and if the economics were to, the political economy there would get straightened around, it could maybe return to its traditional, 100-year-ago source. But other than that, where else is it? I mean, yes, we'll see productivity increases in China and India, but I don't think we're going to see the kind of productivity production transformation we saw in Brazil, because it's very different to go in and open up new lands where there's no existing agriculture. China and India have large agricultures and they have employment issues. Changing those institutions is very difficult. It's very slow. Change is always slow. So, one way or another, it seems to me the Americas has to be the source of growth in the agricultural commodities. And I think some of it will be livestock. Some of it will be growth in corn and beans, energy and protein.
How does U.S. agriculture need to change strategically, whether it be infrastructure, number of farmers, number of business, agribusinesses, to meet global demand for food in the year 2025?
Well, the question I would say that a little bit different is, what do we need to do to be profitable serving global food demand? Because global food demand will be met. The question is, how profitable is your enterprise doing it relative to others? So if we take as somewhat of a given that there are major demand increases as long as the world economy is growing, if you visit with Illinois farmers, as I've done a lot over the last 30 years, and there's been a major shift to where the biggest expense item is cash rent for land. Farms are getting larger, they're using a lot more rented ground as opposed to that owned by the farmer, and much of that today is cash rent. So you focus on what are the sources, why are cash rents as high as they are, and there are structural reasons. They're not making any more of it, and Chicago is growing, and Peoria is growing, and so there's these demands. But we also have to look at farm program and that amount of the land price that essentially is being supported by farm income supports. Some people estimate it's 25% of the land price is due to farm income supports. And it's interesting to talk to young farmers. I vividly remember one sending me an email a year or two ago, and it must have been in November or December, because he had just gotten his farm income payment check, and he'd just written the check for cash rent, and he said, they sort of canceled each other out, and he says, well, what's the point of this? Now, it was really kind of striking the way he phrased it to me in this email, but in terms of real political economics, he was on a major, major important point, and the point is not that we shouldn't, for various reasons, support agriculture, the government should support them. That's a different issue. The question I'm raising is how, and can we figure out ways, if we want to provide the support, that doesn't build it into the cost structure, because that cost structure affects how much profit we're going to make. It doesn't really affect the world price of beans, because that's supply and demand. But how much profit is going back to the productive enterprises, the farmers, if you will, and the farm families, that, to me, is a real interesting policy question.
Mm-hmm. We've just got a couple of minutes left. Do you have any closing comments that you'd like to make, or I can ask you a question?
Well, I would say I think as we look ahead for the next year, the developments in China to me are very exciting. The growth that's going on, the drawdown in stocks, the explosive demand that's occurring there for commodities. Jim Rogers, who has written this book, Hot Commodities, he calls China commodity demand pure potential. And I really think that sums up that country, their ability to convert raw materials into finished products that the West is very interested in buying at very low prices because of their low labor charges. And what that is converting back to in terms of increased spending and income power for the Chinese, the low labor that they have, the low labor costs, and the relatively free and open trade policies they have are an explosive combination for improving incomes. And as with that as a backdrop, for index funds, for grain processors, for end users of grain, one has to ask oneself, am I really comfortable being short any of these commodities over the long term, given what's going on in Asia and our strong economic growth that continues, incidentally, despite these relatively high energy prices. And I think one of the things that's helping those energy, that economic growth, is the lower cost of goods and products that we're buying out of China, the services that we're buying out of India, is helping us to control inflation, keep interest rates low, and in effect cushioning the high prices of crude oil. So China is in here on so many fronts. But for me as a grain analyst, I think the old scatter studies of stocks and where the price should be have to be reevaluated within the context of the developments going on in China.
You said something fairly interesting. I do want to follow up. You wouldn't want to be short any of the commodities. Are we talking soybeans, corn, wheat, and the livestock, the meats?
I'm talking about primarily the protein and the corn.
Soybeans and corn.
Because the wheat, they are the world's largest producer of wheat. Their per capita consumption of wheat is going down, and as they move up the income ladder, they're moving out of wheat-based products and into more protein-based products.
Finally, just because I'd like to know, because when you said this, it tipped to my mind that, of course, the soybean, the proteins have been moved fairly heavily by index funds over the last 6 to 7 months. Is this the kind of background knowledge that they're using to price beans out?
Very much. I think the commodities have come into to vogue as an asset class. Over the last several years, they have outperformed equity funds. There's basically no end in sight that we see in the growth in China unless the West would impose trade restrictions or limits on Chinese imports that would reduce their ability to improve their income and bring people out of poverty and up into more higher income meat buying strata of consumers. So I would say that for the foreseeable future, and certainly led by crude oil, you know, just the entire energy sector, which is another 45-minute discussion, is so unlike soybeans because it is a limited supply, it is expanding demand, there isn't new production facilities being brought online. Only 5% of the Chinese population have cars. It's the fastest growing car market in the world. Volkswagen is selling more cars in China every day than they are in Germany, and that's only going to continue. So with that, that's a positive item for commodities, especially for the metals, and I think to some extent that's going to splash back down into the grains and lend extra support to those markets as well.
Food or raw commodities as a financial benchmark then at some point?
Yes.
All right. Steve, finish up with you. What do you have closing comments on the globalization and internationalization of the marketplace?
Picking up actually on the last question you asked, which was what do we need to do in the U.S., infrastructure, what have you. And as I was looking out at the crowd at the Farm Progress Show, I know every year large numbers of international visitors come to the Farm Progress Show. What came to my mind is our ag leadership, our agribusiness leadership, needs to get to Asia. You need to see Beijing, you need to see Mumbai, you need to see the rural areas. It's not that in a week you become an expert, but you become a lot more sensitive that everything doesn't look like this, and there's lots of potential both as markets and as suppliers. And it's hard to get there, but we just continually, our young ag leadership and our existing leaders in agribusiness as well as in the ag commodities, we need to get to Asia and we need to try to understand Asia because it is very different than the West, and it's very different from our traditional markets, and its pace of change is just awesome. So that's the thing I think we really need to focus on, is make sure we're learning as much about Asia as we can, because it's a very different market than the market of the last century, which was the West, the US and Western Europe. So that would be my last comment.
Steve Sonke is the former director of the National Soybean Research Laboratory at the University of Illinois and professor emeritus of Ag Economics at the U of I. Rich Feltus is the director of research at REFCO. I'm Todd Gleason. You've been listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL.
Live again here at the Farm Progress Show, I'm Todd Gleason. That program, of course, recorded this morning from the stage in the University of Illinois Purdue University tent on the show site. When you come in the main gate at Farm Progress Show, just turn to your right and go about, half a block or so. Dave Dickey's here with me, and he looks like he has something to say. Just welcoming everybody to the show
site. I do want to welcome everybody to the show site, and I also want to say that if you do come, be sure to stop by our booth. Sign up for our free agricultural e-letter. We put that out each and every weekend for you. It's a great way to keep up with the markets and increase your producer-farmer profitability. Free to you. Just come on by. And when you do, you also get into drawing for an iPod, Todd. And some of our people don't know what an iPod is. And I've been saying today, it increases your soybean potential.
You know, somebody heard you say iPod and they thought you said 8-pod. So I said, it was $8 a bushel for soybeans on the iPod. But that's not the case. Speaking of bushels and dollars, let's take a look at what happened to the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon. Real-time quotes here via Dave Dickey and ProfitX and the WILL. It's a great thing to have such good sound quality and it's sort of like working in studio, but not quite. There's a lot more people around. At the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, futures finished like this. September wheat down 3.25, had a high today of 312.5, the low at 307. Settlement price at 307.25. They were down 3.25 for the day. December futures 328.25, the high, the low at 22.5, and a settlement price $3.23.25, and they were down 3 cents for the day. March contract to 340.75, high, low 335.5, settled at 337, down 2.75. In May wheat, 347, the high, the low at 342, settlement price there at 343. They were off 2.5 cents today. July futures down 2 as well, 350.5, the high, the low at 346. Settlement price at 346.75, down 2. From the corn pit, futures down 1.25 today, 207, the high, the low at 203. Settlement price at 203.5, down 1.25. December futures, 221.75, the high, low at 218. Settlement price at 218.5, and they were down 1. March contract at the corn in Chicago, 232, the high, the low at 228.25. Settlement price, 228.75, they were off 1. And May futures for the day, 237.5, the high, low at 234.5, settled 234.75, down 1.25. July contract in the corn pit now, 243.25, the high, the low at 240. Settlement price at $2.40 for the July corn. They were off 3/4 in the September futures, 247, the high, the low at 44.5, and a settlement price at 44.5, down 1. September oats, 146, the high, the low at 142, settled at 142, down 3.5 cents in December futures. 154.5, the high, the low at 151, settled at 151.25, down 3.25. September soybeans, 610, the high, the low at 593.5. Those SEP beans were up 5.75, but look at that high again, $6.10. They made a pretty good rally today. We'll talk with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodity Markets about what happened in the bean market today a little later in the program at about 6 after the hour during the closing market report today. The Septembers, by the way, settled at 599.75. They were up 5.75 for the day. November beans, 622.25, the high, low at 604.5. Settlement price at 611, a nickel higher. January futures, 629.5, the high, the low at 612.5. Settlement there at 618.5, up 5.25. And the March soybeans, 635, the high, the low at 18.5. Settlement price at 625.25. They were up 6 on the day in the May soybeans, 637, the high, the low at 621. Settlement price at $6.28. And they were up 5.5 cents on the day. July futures 640, the high, the low at 626. Settlement at 631, up 4.75. Bean meal futures September contract 187.70, the high, the low at 184. Settlement price at 184.60. They were up 30 cents for the day. And the October contract up 20, a 185.60. Settlement price, the high at 188.80. Settlement price at 184.80. September bean oil up 62, 23.20, the high, the low at 22.30, settlement price at 22.86, up 62 for the day. In the October bean oil, 23.37, the high, the low at 22.40, settlement price at 23.01. They finished 65 higher for the day. I'll be back live from the Farm Progress Show with my compadre here on the site Dave Dickey, your Director of Agricultural Programming, at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock. Now here are the settlements from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. A lower day today for livestock prices on the Merc. September feeder cattle, the high 112.40, the low 111.30, the settlement 111.60, that down 77 and a half. October 111.02 and a half, the high 109.65, the low 110.07 and a half, the settlement, that down 55. November 109.90, the high 108.55, the low 109.20, the settlement, that down 47 and a half. August live cattle, 83.45, the high 82.20, the low 82.75, the settlement, that down 47 and a half. October live cattle, 83.60, the high 82.07 and a half, the low, the settlement 82.52 and a half, that down 107 and a half. October lean hog, 64.40, the high 63.42 and a half, the low, the settlement 63.82 and a half, that down 7 and a half. December, 61.75, the high, 60.80, the low, 61 even, the settlement, that down 45. February, lean hog, 62.20, the high, 61.25, the low, the settlement, 61.92 and a half, that down 37 and a half. April, lean hogs, the high today, 60.10, the low, 59.30, the settlement, 59.85, that finishing off 15 cents. And February bellies, 82.15, the high 80.90, the low 81.30, the settlement, that down 45. The Dow is off 97 points at 10,366, the NASDAQ down 17 at 2120, the S&P 500 9 lower at 1203.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Andrew High from Alberta, Canada writes, Dear Dr. Science, how can I densify water? I need to float a paperclip for a science experiment in school.
Since water is already plenty dense, the only way to densify it is to trick it into momentarily thinking that it's air and then slip jello into the spaces between the molecules. And then before water knows what happened, it'll be jiggly, colorful, sweet-tasting food byproduct that looks great wearing a little cap of Cool Whip. Hey, you might notice I'm using brand names here. Well, it's not because I'm on the take in product placement like the big boys in Hollywood are. No, it's because I've got nothing to lose and no reason to kowtow to General Foods or anybody else.
Thank you, Dr. Science.
Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.